Welcome to our session, Meet 303. My name is John Weber. I'm a principal consulting engineer for CDW on the Unified Communications delivery team. My job is to do everything from pre-sales all the way down to post-sales implementation. I'm typically involved in almost nothing but Link. I do a little bit of Exchange, a little bit of Active Directory, you know, because we touch all that. But primarily, I do Link deployments. A little bit of history on me. I retired from the Army in 98 and got a job about 5 days later because I was stupid and put my resume out there. And I've been working ever since. I've been concentrating almost purely on Microsoft products since about 2001. And Exchange and LCS, OCS, Link, since about 2002, 2003. I'm a MVP for a couple years now, which is pretty cool. I had no idea what I did to get it, but something. I would encourage questions as we go, rather than holding them to the end. I don't think I have an hour and 15 minutes of content for you. My intent is to raise more questions from you than maybe I answer. Our subject matter here is the planning considerations for Link Meeting, specifically around edges, multiple edges, geographically dispersed edges, that kind of concept. And there's one or two scenarios that I'm going to put up on the board eventually. And I have some real life pictures that we've done. So, I mean, what you're going to see from me isn't a theoretical model. It's what I've actually deployed and what I actually learned from those deployments and how they might apply to you. I thought that was a better approach than just statically throwing up media flows, which have already been done, showing you how a client logs in, which has already been done, that kind of thing. Does that meet everybody's expectations? So the agenda, a little bit of intro, business requirements. I start every project with nothing but business requirements. And I know the IT staff that I'm dealing with doesn't want to hear it, but I don't think that a Link deployment can be done without considering what the target is. And then we design the system to deliver those deliverables. If you go back through a bunch of the Gartner and IBM studies, there's like three reasons why IT projects fail. One of them is lack of executive sponsorship. One of the other ones is scope creep. And part of the scope creep is not defining the requirements very accurately. So I always start with business requirements. And then I work through what's the technical solution to meet that business requirement. And then as we're going to demonstrate up here, as you loop through the business requirements and the technical requirements to meet the business requirements, you might need to loop back to the top several times in an iterative fashion until you've met all your requirements, and maybe choosing something like dial-in conferencing might change your opinion about enterprise voice. And dial-in conferencing has been part of every Link deployment I've done. They might not want it walking in the door, but by the time I leave, they're saying we need this. All right. One of the bigger drivers for Link is letting those people log in or access the conference from their cell phone, maybe driving down the freeway. And then they realize, well, I can't do that without an internet. So pretty soon we're putting dial-in conferencing in place, which requires part of enterprise voice. So planning considerations, I think, need to be done up front, and then we meet the requirements on the backside. Policy concerns, we're going to cover not real deeply, but I want to make sure that I highlight that these policies that we have in place and the various combinations of them need to be thought about before we start pushing buttons and deploying servers. For you, for instance, because you global, you're going to want to make sure that we have possibly three or four different tiers of meeting organizers. You might want to think about large meetings versus small meetings. Microsoft has a whole raft of metrics that indicate that the average meeting is maybe four or five or six people, maybe as much as 10, that those happen a lot. But occasionally, your company might have a need for a really large meeting, maybe 1,000 people. Maybe the CEO is doing some sort of presentation kind of thing. And you want to think about that before you start deploying also. The basics, what I mean by that is I'm going to be putting up some material that I developed for myself of here's just an internal deployment. Then we're going to add dial-in conferencing to it. Then we're going to add another site to it. Then we're going to add an edge to it. And at each step through that, I want to loop back through, what do you think need to think about when you're planning out that kind of a deployment and what you might want to be looking at as you step through all that, all right? And then complexity, I've got those real-life scenarios for you I'm going to show you. Objectives. I would like for you to take out of here the definition of a conference, if nothing else. Understanding what the edge impact is, understanding what the site impact on the edge is, and how that impacts your internal deployment. And then conferencing impact on things like network and DNS, DHCP, bandwidth usage, why you might want to put up a second site even if you don't think you have the numbers needs to support that. I've got a customer that is running a second site purely because their WAN link is bad. And they don't want the conference traffic because they know that those meetings are going to take place internally to that site. So they put up a second service pool there just to constrain that traffic a little bit. They thought that was cheaper than going out to whoever their provider was in that country just to put up another more bandwidth. All right, business requirements. This is the typical list that I see when I walk in the door. They want to maintain virtualization. They want to do things like HA and DR. By the way, everybody knows that HA and DR are two different animals. I see lots of nods, but I spend probably an hour sometimes describing what the difference is between HA and Link and DR and Link and why I think they're different and how it might impact their deployment. So we cover HA and DR. One of the prime reasons why we come into web link conferencing is they want to have that web conferencing deployed out. They see a cost savings potential. So when we start talking about web conferencing, however, people think that they need to have something special deployed as opposed to I can just stand up a standard edition and if you've got a Link client, we can start conferencing. Because in my opinion, Link thinks everything is a conference. Two people IMing back and forth in Link is almost a conference because we can just escalate right up. So you need to think about those different scenarios that we're looking at and how you might want to plan for today to come up in our pilot. But maybe let's think 6 months down the road when this thing goes viral, and it will. And all of a sudden, you've got every user clamoring for it, and you're scrambling to put web conferencing in place or allow for it. Dial-in conferencing, I already mentioned. Everybody wants dial-in conferencing. But not everybody realizes they need to have a SIP trunk or they need to have something to their PBX, and that something to the PBX might require a gateway or gateways plural depending on the HA and the DR scenario that they're looking at. Compliance and archiving is a business requirement to me. How many people have a legal requirement to archive IMs, for instance? So that is a conference to me if you've got two people or more in it. And so that might, just from a conferencing standpoint, might be a requirement that we need to consider. So now we're going to be talking about putting SQL in place. We might be talking about going to talk to audio codes, about getting SmartTAP put in place so we can really record it. So there's a wide variety of ranges there. I always recommend that the clients put out monitoring servers so you can take a look at the various metrics of what's going on from the client perspective and the server perspective so that you can help troubleshoot. Everybody knows about CLS logging. Have we played with it to a certain extent where you know that the always-on scenario will provide you almost everything you need to know about this? How many people turn it on?
I turn it on. The only issue is just a comment about sometimes I always have to restart it over time, over like after a month or so.
You know what I've noticed is that when you go stop CLS logging with a scenario, uh-huh. You have to wait for it to shut itself off also. And it takes a bit for the agents to catch up. How long of a delay have you noticed in I have to restart services for that?
A lot of times I'm restarting because I'm trying to track an issue. Mm-hmm. And I didn't get to capture at the time that the user tested at the time that I was trying to look at the issue. And I'll restart it. I'd usually wait about 5 minutes before I have them try again.
Okay.
I didn't know if that was something that you can improve upon.
If you get with me after the session, I'd be happy to talk to you about it. I think it's out of scope for our session here.
Agreed.
But I'd be happy to discuss it with you. External policies. That one's in brackets because I would say that 90% of the time when I walk into a customer site and I'm going to be doing their project, they very rarely have considered the impact of how their policies will affect their users. And what I mean by that is, if I put together a policy that allows me to make a 25-person user conference, and I've got, let's say, three or four different tiers, and I've gone through the organization, the organizer policies, and maybe a little bit of the participant policy, that when Mary Lou talks to Billy Bob about how she got it done, she might give him the wrong set of instructions. So in a larger organization, you might want to consider in the policies section some deliberate user training. Now there's some really good stuff out there on how to do the basics of it, but that scenario of the user talking to the user and trying to help them out, which is a very common scenario, and it's really good of them to do that, but they might be getting the wrong instructions and now we've just generated a help desk call, or maybe more than one. And then the IT guy gets involved. And it starts to snowball, but if we think about it ahead of time, maybe we can work with our HR department or whoever you've got and put together some basic user training around each scenario that you think you might need to support, and maybe we can make things go a bit easier. And then we have the last one, external access. External access is mobility. It's my cell phone that's sitting in my jacket pocket. It might be an iPad, it might be a Droid, it might be a Windows Surface. It might be somebody sitting in I work out of my house, so I'm always remote, I'm always external. It might be somebody sitting in an airport. Everybody see the Microsoft commercial where they go, to the cloud. And they're sitting in a completely crowded airport. It's like, what bandwidth were they using? But let's talk about external access and bandwidth and how much one person hosting a client conference, how much bandwidth might they be using? So there's some considerations. Most people don't have the pipe size on their external links that they have on the inside, and they kind of expect it to operate externally the same way it operates for people on the inside. So there's a planning consideration there, a little bit of triple beam action going back and forth. How much do I give them? How much do I take away? All right. Any questions on that kind of stuff, those kind of concepts? Policy concerns. Policy concerns cover who can get in, meaning who am I going to allow into my conference? Specifically on the compliance side, who can record? So if I was hosting this meeting out of my house, for instance, and I'm going to be up the pools in Chicago, I might not want to let a federated user record my material. But you might have other users that you're going to allow a conference to organize, organizer, to allow that conference to be recorded. And we can go and start making these tiers of user policies of who can record, who can't. Maybe you don't want to allow the federated users to be able to take control of the keyboard and the mouse during presentations. Even if they could share and if they are participating, maybe you don't want to allow them to do that. These are all policy issues that we need to think about maybe before we start deploying, because it might in the end drive the need for having a meeting policy that says everybody's going to be locked down, nobody gets to change it. That starts driving questions like, how many conference directories do I need? You will probably need more than one conference directory, for instance. So you might want to think about that ahead of time. That one starts driving the question of how do I name my new conference directory so I don't blow out my PSTN identifier to about 9,000 digits and have people like me with short-term memory loss going, the hell is that number? And I get it wrong four or five times in a row. Meeting size is important. I did a project out of Chicago where they deliberately wanted a 1,000-person meeting once a quarter, CEO presentation. Okay, then we stood up a whole other pool for it. But when you stand up a whole other pool for it, how do we get our PSTN into it? Well, there's a path that we can take, which is land it on the regular pool and let it proxy it over, and it works pretty well. But then the question becomes, with my bandwidth from pool to pool, then my question becomes, if I'm hosting it over there, who's going to record it? Who's going to organize it? Because the CEO is not going to do it. So now we start driving a bunch more planning considerations around the meeting, the policy, who's going to do it, who's going to run it. When was the last time we saw a CXO want to broker his own meeting in terms of somebody wants to run the Q&A, somebody wants to keep track of all the users, someone needs to help them out on the tech support side if they can't get in. All these little things that we kind of just gloss over have an impact on the user experience down the road and our ability to say we've been completely successful with our deployment. And I've already covered user training about 5 times, so I won't beat that one. And large meetings I just covered. Any questions?
How are you defining large meeting?
Yeah, so here we go again. Again, the triple beam thing. So I think the book says 250, all right? I know that if you give it enough horsepower that you can run larger than that, but it also depends on what else that pool is having to do. So I've done several deployments where they left everything running on one pool, and then we stood up another standard edition pool in this case. And the people that were doing these one size of conferences, and they were running 35 and 40 people at a pop, but they had a bunch of them. We ran them all off another pool so that other server that was handling all the AV work for all the common folk weren't being impacted by these meetings that were taking place, 200-300 of them at a time. So does that answer your question? Then there's also the consideration, back up to the other slide on the VM question for business requirements. If you start putting this thing in virtual, which is completely supported, we start cutting our numbers in half for how many people we can handle. So if you look at the documentation where they say, oh, here's the, you know, we need 8 cores and 32 gigs and this, that's for one node of an 80,000 user pool. So we do a quick little bit of math and that's 7,500. So if we virtualize it with exactly those kind of hardware specs, now we can reasonably expect to get maybe 3,000, 3,500 users. But that's just IM. What about the AV and the all the rest of the functions? So it's a back and forth action. Yes, sir. So I cannot speak to the actual answer because I don't work for Microsoft. I can speak to what I've been told by various people in that if there wasn't a change that needed to show up in the 2013 documentation, the 2010 applies. Okay. Because I've asked that very question also. There's gaps in the documentation stack, and that's the answer I keep getting. They keep giving me that answer. So that means you can take the usage models and the capacity planning and their usage models that they use to build the capacity planning that nowhere say cut your numbers in half when you go virtual.
Right.
But the 2010 documentation says it. So that one little piece slides forward in my mind, which is why I said it that way. It's not the best answer in the world.
There are no specs for 2013, so that means take the specs from 2010. So you can't slide that over, but you can say, you know, and slide everything over.
I agree. I don't have a better answer for you. But it's a great observation because I've made it myself. That makes us both great.
Yeah.
Is everybody else seeing that also? Where the documentation stack says kind of, and then it doesn't say anything at all? And then you go back to the 2010 side and you can find the reference, but you can't find it in the 2013 side? Great piece of feedback. Here's the matrix for conferencing policies. I deliberately put this together. I wasn't trying to represent this as being like the model. It's more that you can go, this piece is on, this piece is off, this piece is, you can go right, and you can build yourself a little crosshatch of it. And you could probably work up 9 or 10 or 20 or 30 more variations of this. And when you start getting to this level, the need for that user training that I was talking about, and maybe helping people understand what you're going to do and how you're going to do it and where you're going to place them, becomes more important. Because if you have somebody running this profile right here where they can do application sharing but not audio and video, and Mary Lou tells Billy Bob, look what I can do, and Billy Bob turns around and says, I can only get two people. I can never add a third person. And that's because I put a conferencing policy in place to enforce licensing that only lets two people into a conference. Everybody catch that one? That's how I do it. There's probably more ways to do it, but if you take the conferencing policy and cut them down to only two people, I can IM with you. We can IM just fine, but neither one of us will ever drag him into it. Because I just made my IM conference only two people by policy. I mean, there's ways you can run this that, you know, go back and forth, and that's just one example. I'm sure I have other notes on that. What do you do about controlling the default user setting? In this scenario here, because I put a bunch of user policies, you know, kind of just created them, that global up there is what's going to apply to the users. So if you fire up 100 users overnight, the next day when they log in, they're going to get a conferencing policy that gives them global everything. And until you apply a different policy to them, they're wide open and running with it. If you then turn around and say, well, you can't really have that, we've just created another help desk call because now Billy Bob can't do what he did the day before. So you might want to think about when you create your users that you assign the conferencing policies ahead of time, but that would require you to have the conferencing policies all laid out before you started. Before you even got around to doing that first user, we need to be thinking about all of these things. Otherwise, we could be generating ourselves some really thorny issues. As a real life scenario, we fired up about 10,000 users one night and we had missed in our little project plan, we need to take care of this. And we had set the global for everybody, and the VP of marketing showed up with his iPad going, I want it. It's because the Mac guy down the path, his mobility lit up, because mobility, which is hiding behind the weeds, is turned on by default. We had all the DNS and all the records set up for it. Off we went. The guy said, oh, look what I can do. 15 seconds later, the VP marketing find out about it, and he's down there saying, I want it. He was never destined to be turned on. We ended up having to turn the whole thing off for a while we got it straightened out. But if we had thought about it ahead of time, maybe we could have gotten around that. Here's the organizer policy. As outlined straight out of the book, this is the defaults. Note that we can have 250 for the max dialing, max meeting size. You can crank that up as high as you want. I think it'll take four digits. I don't think it's a good plan to do so. Again, Microsoft has metrics that show that the average meeting size is four or five people. I typically take the default global and strip it to nothing. I uncheck everything and make the average user, when they first turn up, they get nothing. Again, enforcing our little piece right here of I want to have nothing, and then I'm going to enable something, as opposed to giving them everything in sight and then taking it away. That way I control my pilot, I control my initial pilot groups. I can more easily identify maybe some trouble spots in my deployment, and that I have to turn my test users on also, which allows my client-facing counterparts to have the ability, have the knowledge transfer of what's it going to take to do this kind of thing, which might be another part of your project that you might want to consider, which would be, what training does my IT admin need? A lot of this stuff can be user-centric, but the basics need to be done for them. Down at the bottom, on the data collaboration side, we have a couple of important points for compliance. Do we want to allow participants to transfer files? I hear a lot of people say, well, we're going to be cutting down our email usage because we're going to be using IM and we're not going to be sending files back and forth anymore. Well, that's great, but it's company culture to send files by email. So ability to transfer files in the IT world is a matter of renaming the extension and sending it anyway, which might go around somebody's rules, which means you might want to consider turning that little piece off and not supporting it, which will really make people mad, especially me. Enabling polls, questions and answers. Do you really need that kind of stuff for the smaller meetings? Or do you want to reserve those kind of functions for the larger meetings where you might find it to be more of a use? Application sharing at the top, data collaboration, and application sharing are not necessarily the same thing. How do I describe that difference? Data collaboration covers the ability for me to interact with you. Application sharing is I'm literally going to share my desktop with you. I do a lot of remote deployments where as soon as I get the edge up for their environment, as soon as I get their pool up, I'm flopped over off of whatever they're using, and I'm going to start using Link so I can control it, and I just host that out of my data center. But I do all of this. For my user object, I always have it all turned on because I need all of it at one point in time, another interaction with a customer. For a larger environment that's going to be lots of users, maybe multiple pools, maybe not all of this is required for every meeting or every user or every group. This participant policy here talks to the compliance issue that I brought up. Do you really want people to be peer-to-peer file transfer in the middle of a meeting? Do you really want them to be recording while you're in a meeting? Because then you have no control over it. We can't stop somebody from sitting there and writing down screen content with a pen and a piece of paper. We can't stop them from breaking out their cell phone and taking pictures of the screen. But that's going to be outside the legal compliance anyway. What we can do is we can stop everybody else from recording it. Planning considerations. You people are probably saying, finally. The scenarios that I can see, domain users internal, domain users external, and we got federated users, and we got anonymous users. We got people that need to come into your meeting potentially with no client whatsoever. We got people that want to do PowerPoint presentations, and everybody know that you need to have a WAS or you're not doing presentations, period. It'll just, 2013 client will come up and say, too bad for you. And a WAS is really easy to stand up. And who all here has actually stood up a WAS server? Sweet. Was it hard, easy, in between?
Pretty easy.
The bandwidth consumption. So on these scenarios, when I'm talking about bandwidth consumption, everybody knows that HD video is basically a meg per desktop. And if you've got a 10 meg link between site A and site B, and you get 10 people in your meeting, you've just blown your bandwidth. So you might want to consider going in there and setting it down to VGA, for instance. Or maybe for the general meeting population, not allowing the video whatsoever. Because you might have other traffic on that WAN link. Lots of people don't consider the fact that just because the guy says, oh, I got 100 megs. Well, what's the concurrency rate today? So you go down and get the network guy, and he says, well, we're running about 65% saturation. It's like, well, that's great, but that only leaves me 35 megs for this. And what about backups? What about, what about? The more questions I can generate on what about, or what about this scenario, what about that scenario during the planning sessions, I think the better off you'll be. So let's build this thing from basic. Here we've got a single standard edition. Nothing fancy. I've stood it up in my environment. It's sitting on the internal production WAN, and those are the clients that can connect to it. I would say that I could expand this a little bit and say that I can probably get an iPad or a Droid or any other WAP-oriented device to connect to this if you do it the right way, and you give it a place to land that's equivalent to an outside connection. It's a little bit out of our comfort zone for this level, so I won't go there. But I can definitely get a phone to connect to it. If it's a Link phone edition, it'll go right in. We got some EV considerations to match at that point. But basically, this is as easy as it gets. So let's add PSTN to it. All of a sudden, we've now lit up the ability for a cell phone to dial into your conferencing while driving down the street. Somebody from their house can dial in now. Somebody from wherever can dial in. This is probably the very core basic minimum requirements to me to enable that. But you'll also notice that there's this little puppy right up in here, which is called the gateway. That PSTN doesn't always have the ability to come straight into Link. The OIP changes about every 6 months, I'm guessing. It's not updated as frequently as I'd like to see it, but this, it's the way that goes. I recently did a project with X5 where we got through the sales presentation part where it's yes, 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 please sign here. And when we actually got around to doing it, we were halfway through it, and their tech said, oh, you need to have a gateway for this because we don't support it without it. So that gateway piece, I think, needs to be considered way before you even deploy the first server. It can take time to get them off the supplier market. It might take time, in the case of audio codes, 2 to 3 weeks to get the remote deployment assistance built up. It just takes time. And every time we start slipping the schedule, we start looking less successful. So if we think about it ahead of time, we can set expectations and they meet expectations. This little piece right here is representing not only just the interior phone system, but it could be another PBX, IP-PBX, or anything else. Once we have a gateway in place, we can get almost anywhere. Once we have a gateway in place, I've never run across something that a gateway can't talk to and translate for us, which means almost every phone in your system can now dial in. You might not even need the PST on the outside because you don't want to enable that, but you might want to enable all the desk phones to be able to dial in so people can just dial in, because that might be the company culture. They join a conference call, they pick up the phone and call. They don't think about going clickety-clickety, join a customer call from Link. Let's add a second site. Now that we've added a second site to it, we've also added a couple of different items here with little red squares there called firewalls. I'm doing a project out of California where we were having trouble with client connections and server-to-client connections and server-to-server connections, and I asked their network manager, can you please confirm that we don't have anything being blocked at the firewall? And he said, we don't have firewalls on the WAN connections. Okay, so rather than argue with him, I broke out the documentation stack and sent him the client and server port and protocol list out of the documentation and said, then you need to check all these ports, which they didn't want to do because it goes, what, 5 pages down the stack. They eventually admitted that there was a firewall problem and they were, in fact, blocking ports that we needed. But how many people think about this on their internal side? That this is a real, I have not done a Link project where the firewalls and the networks weren't negatively impacting our project, ever, even on a very small one. Firewalls will definitely impact your performance. Maybe the firewall in the case of the mid-range SONIC walls start running out of port connections on the TCP stack. You put too many connections on it, they just stop working. So we need to think about some of this stuff. The PSTN connection from maybe site A into site 2 needs to be considered. How am I going to get that media flow over to my second pool? Will that cause more firewall issues? Worse yet, once I get through the firewall, maybe I've got a riverbed or something that's doing hardware acceleration for my WAN that might be getting in the way. Everybody remember the OWA? Was the HTTP MAPI encryption piece out of Riverbeds before version 5, where it would connect and then drop, it's just maddening. Well, they fixed it with firmware, but if you knew about it ahead of time, you'd just turn encryption off and fly through it until they got their other work done. So there's things like that to consider. All right, so let's add an edge to this. Adding the edge adds another layer of firewalls. This, by the way, is the classic layout out of the documentation for best practice with an internal firewall, the official DMZ with 2 subnets, an external firewall. Was there a question?
No.
Okay. With an external firewall, you know, NATing through. I've seen people put their edges up as a peer of the firewall, which does work, but I wouldn't recommend it. I've also done many projects where they choose to do away with the inside firewall and they put the inside edge of their edge server on their production network. That becomes to me a security risk, but it might be meeting their needs for a variety of reasons to have their risk assessment says that we don't have enough at risk here to justify putting another firewall in place. What I do as a consultant is my job is to give out all the options and how I think it needs to be, and then help them choose the best option for themselves. But it's their choice, not mine. Not always a fun discussion when we get to this point here. The PSTN is still in play over here. We've still got our gateway, we've still got an IP PBX. This firewall right here, for planning considerations, has a completely different set of rule sets than the one at the top. If nothing else, for your centralized logging solution, 15,000 1 through 3, you need to go outbound through that, the bottom firewall.
When I look at the logging on the edge, it's actually, maybe looking at the wrong server, but I think it's disabled.
The logging is disabled?
Yeah.
So it's never been turned on? Because maybe your ports aren't open.
Yeah, I actually, the only reason I say that, because I just looked at it right before, you know, the weekend.
Uh-huh. Yeah, the pretty picture for the edge server has got a left and a right side mm-hmm. with the pretty colored arrows with the port numbers going back and forth.
Right.
If you don't look in the right spot in the 2013 stack, they still have the 2010 picture in there. So you have to go. I could probably show it to you. They might have fixed it since the last time I looked at it, but it took me about three or four times looking at it, going, something's wrong here. And then I realized it's the 2010 picture with the 2010 pretty pictures and arrows and protocol directions.
Okay.
And it's for it's in the 2013 documentation. So that might have been something that got you on that one. So we've now got four firewalls, or at the very minimum, two firewalls, double-legged kind of thing, where I'm going out and then back in. And then if on the outs and back ins, depending on the firewall rules, you could have a combination of events. Another project I recently worked on where their internal people did not handle their firewalls. Their internal people handled that firewall, but not that one and that one and that one at the top. And so the documentation that we had to put together to provide to that outside third party to configure the firewall the way we wanted it to be and not the way they wanted it to be took us longer than deploying the edge servers did. Had to be in a certain format, the charts had to look in a certain way. We had to have a column for direction, and then we had the directions backwards because they had they read it backwards kind of thing. We went through that probably for a good week. So planning considerations for this scenario right here are these firewalls, the PSTNs, what kind of client connections we're gonna have, and then this link right here, how many people put, I just broke out the doggone IANA stack and I labeled them, you know, 192.0.3.2 and 1.4 and 5. How many people consider the fact that they got clients that are sitting over here that edge server needs to talk to directly? Everybody know how to do static routes? And if you don't, you'll learn kind of thing. And did you know that in 2012, the common methodology of route add hyphen p is being deprecated for NetSH commands? Like, holy crap! And then there's PowerShell versions of it. So, what does your staff or your internal people or maybe your external provider, how do they want to see those commands get set up? We also need to consider if I've got a meeting that's been organized on this subnet over here. What's my media flow from this edge server down over to here? Again, I didn't want to cover media flows in this, but suffice it to say that I could have a set of simple URLs that feed my main site, and we'll get to it when we add a second edge, but the media flow is going to be coming back and forth this way. But it needs to land on this here pool first, because that's the next hop for the edge. So we now start opening up more and more ports across this path here, or having the potential for having to pay attention to that kind of work and that kind of detail, just to get a simple one-person meeting to somebody from the outside. And if somebody starts adding users to it, maybe they're external, maybe they're internal, we start stacking this thing up. If we organized a big pool here, let's say we got a 50-person meeting here, and we got all 50 people turned on for HD, and we only got a 5 meg line right here, what's that going to do to us? I'm sorry?
Oopsie.
Yeah, oopsie is right. I didn't pick that one out of the air, by the way. I ran across that. It's fine. But every time we have a meeting over here, it just starts going horrible. And the audio drops off. We can't get connected. It's like, yeah, how big is the pipe? How many people in the meeting? It's like the old HP printers that were facing the sun, and at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, they stopped printing because the IR port got exposed to the sun, and it just froze it. So it took us a while to find it. We used the monitoring server, and finally the network guy admitted that, well, that's a pretty saturated link anyway. It's like, no, really? All right. Does everybody grasp how we've got to here? Any questions so far?
Just one question. So you're making the assumption that the reverse proxy is somewhere in that mix around the edge?
That right there, you mean?
That's what you built
that. Yeah, sorry.
All right.
The 2013, you didn't hear me say this. The 2013 stencils, I think, are less than explicit. I like the old ones better, but I made a point of using these ones. Unless you read the little tag on it, and I didn't want to label everything kind of thing. So that's the river. Yes?
Before you add a second edge, what about split top on the VPN? There's nothing that I've found on Microsoft that says it's required. So we have a hard time making this a security group to enable split tunneling.
So split tunneling, you're talking about letting a remote user VPN in and have link traffic not use that VPN tunnel. So the purpose of doing that is to avoid the 30% compression loss across VPN, of course. Is that something you've looked at that you absolutely want to do, or you think it's a requirement? So way back on slide number one, when I asked about business requirements, what's the VPN used for? And now we've just created a scenario where we're down, you know, in the middle of day 12 in our planning, and we've all of a sudden went right back to the very first slide and said, well, we've just modified that. And that's a great observation. I would say put the split VPN tunnel in place, because you're going to come across a VPN and Link is just going to not do what you want it to do. You're going to have a horrible user experience. And I'm not aware of any official documentation that says, yes, you got to have it, no, you don't need it. I know that I would never recommend running a Link across a VPN tunnel. It simply is not required. And if you're going to go through all the business of putting this whole structure in place up here, why would you use it? I assume you're using VPN for other things like normal logins. Have you considered DA? I would think that DA would be a much better solution set for you. And you can go into the DA DNS entries and just start excluding everything for your Link project, and it goes right around it, and it's perfect.
Yeah, it's Microsoft best practice that they gave the DNS solution to us for the tunneling and fully endorsed it, helped us through with it.
Yeah, it's a great solution set. It's just not, yeah. Anything else? Okay, so there's the one scenario that I mentioned where a client comes in that does not have a Link client. That's obviously LWA. But then you've got a subset of the client solution where if you have a Pro Plus 2013 license for Office and everybody just installs it, in it goes, that client, that workstation just got a copy of Link client. But they don't have Link deployed. You send them the Link invite, and you get this one, and it says this right here in it. So he goes, oh, nice. Click, click, and up pops his Link client, and it fails to join the meeting. Well, the reason why is because he's not logged in, and we've just run across a little thing called, I'm not a federated or anonymous user, and I don't have a Link client, I really can't log in, because there's no way for the Link client to authenticate into the session because he's not logged in. The way around that is to force this little SL equals one piece. That requires a little cut and paste action, modify the hyperlink, then paste it back in. And
so
I,
that forces you to use the...
that forces, yes.
Wow.
I have no clue. That's been around since, I'd like to say R1, that little solution. It works really well. What it does is it forces the link client to not, it forces the LWA client, at which point they get the little plug-in download, and they're fully enabled for audio, for video. They're full participant at that point. It's basically a full link client download on the fly.
So you need the question mark as well?
Yeah, everything from there over, from the 2W, see where it says 2W right there? Under NDA, that's my meeting organizer code. Everything from that question mark over needs to get added. And then you need to get, and I always give them a second link to click on that says join without a, join like that.
Would you change your template so that everybody has that? Or you
wouldn't that be nice? it's a very common DCR. I was on a call probably not more than 2 weeks ago, and they're asking this and asking that. And I said, four or five of us said, hey, how about we come up with both no matter what? When you click on Make It a Link Meeting in Outlook, that it automatically does this for us. Will it ever happen? I don't know. I'm not aware of any methodology to even modify the. I'm sure it's a DLL somewhere that's generating this, and I'm not going to touch it. I don't want to break it. It's a manual. That's a manual methodology that I do. If they fit that one scenario of they've deployed Office 2013 with Link and they don't have a Link login, Link is more than likely going to be active on their desktop. And when they click on your meeting link, it's going to try to open Link, but they're not going to have a login, so it'll never complete. You need to buy me two because my wife's here.
Quick question. So we talked about the templates, and I know we're getting off topic here, but so can you default this for a particular user group where anytime they schedule a meeting, it's always the Link Web App client that they're going to require those users to use to connect?
So if I understand your question right, mm-hmm. Can I make the left-hand side always look like the right-hand side?
Right.
No, not that I'm aware of.
You want to write that down? Thanks.
That you want a DCR?
Yeah. Well, actually, I see a mode there.
Yeah, it's a very common question.
Yeah, that would be fantastic.
It's great feedback that everybody wants it.
Right.
The more people, by the way, that contact their TAM and ask for it, the more likely it is we're going to get it.
I will. Thanks.
They just say all email addresses.
Do they really?
Yeah.
Okay. Anything else? All right. So what's impacted by an edge? And I think I already covered a lot of it. We're talking subnets. How many people know that their network VLAN people, when they create a VLAN, can constrict ports on it? Maybe they're going to let 80 and 443 go through and nothing else. Maybe they're going to open up 135, 445, 446 to let the DC traffic go through, but nothing else. Again, projects I've worked on where they say, oh, we're not doing any of that. By the time you get done troubleshooting and doing telnet port to port, you find out that, oh, well, when we set the VPN up or the VLAN up, we didn't add enough ports for you. DHCP gets affected by the edge because, how do I say this? The DHCP on the edge sometimes, if you're in a domain like that has like a full domain in the DMZ, I've noticed that when I stood the server up, we couldn't find it no more. It's because the NIC was registering its second address in with DHCP because they hadn't turned it off yet. And all of a sudden it wrote back into DNS, I can't find it. at which point we're manually going down the data center, logging into the console, trying to find our server, which we know is there. We're looking at it. So when I say DHCP here, what I mean is when you stand up an edge server, you might want to be taking a look at the idea of, I got two NICs, one of them needs to register in DNS and one of them doesn't. Where does my default gateway go? Where does my static routes go? What network does it go onto? That never comes into it until you start putting an edge in place. DNS, we got an internal DNS, an external DNS. How many people put their DNS always pointing to the inside? Or do you put your edges with it looking to the outside world for DNS? I'm sorry? So Microsoft best practice in the documentation is always point the edge server outward. I always like it pointing inward. So when I'm having DNS problems, I know where my DNS problem is coming from. It's coming from my internal server. That's just how I do it. That make sense? Something you need to think about when we start putting edge in place is, how are we going to resolve names? The edge server, if it can't find av.domain.com, for instance, might have some issues with finding itself and being able to refer itself to the outside world so people can find it in return. We've already talked about the firewall points.
Just a quick question in that regard.
Yeah.
Regarding DNS. So if you point it to the outside, how is it finding the front end pool?
You have to static route it or host file it or something. Which is, I always point my servers to the inside. Typically what I do is I go through a little DNS talk, and I make sure how I understand their DNS is working, where it's coming from. Is it a Windows server? Maybe they're using Blue Coat or something. How does my zone look? And we'll come to that in a minute on my real world example. I'm going to show you a DNS chart for one of these projects that I've got. And it runs 60, 70 lines down the page of all the DNS entries that need to get made for this. So I don't want an outside provider affecting my system performance. And so I know that the book answer is point the edge server to the outside world for DNS resolution. But then when something's not going quite right, I'm then looking at, well, where is the not quite right information coming from? Is it coming from here or is it coming from over here? In my case, I want to know where it's coming from so I have some control over it.
And that's why we have.
And I hate host files because everybody always forgets about them. Did that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay. Switches. Everybody knows that switches do layer 2, layer 3. Did you know that when you start doing VLANs on them, you can cut down your ports? And you might have someone who put together a VLAN, and I'm bringing it up again because I've seen it more than once, that they mess with their network, and that messes with link. And then they don't tell you about it, or you walk in to do a deployment or add a component, and all of a sudden it's not working. You're chasing your tail forever, and it turns out to be a network or a firewall issue. HLB, we haven't even covered that yet because I'm not trying to go to that level. How many people use HLB for their enterprise pool? DNSLB on top of that. When they came out with that, I think that's the neatest thing since sliced bread. DNSLB is an absolute godsend to a link deployment. But we still need to have this HLB thing. I brought up the HLB in this scenario because we can use it for reverse proxy. As of last November when they cut TMG, and the only way we can get TMG is you already got it deployed. TMG was my reverse proxy of choice. Now I have to use load balancers for it. If you're going to go that route and you see that coming in your initial planning stages, this becomes a question. What am I going to use for a reverse proxy? What am I going to use for my HLB? And I'm putting it in here because about 9 slides back where I'm talking about planning considerations, when we get to the very bottom where we say external access, that's this list right here. And so if it doesn't come up then and now it's just come up, we now need to loop all the way back to the top and start working out DNS charts again, where they're going to land, how they're going to do it. The HLB as a reverse proxy might give you the ability to put mobile solutions in place even without an edge server. By doing the DNS correctly, you can land an iPad on a WAP and have the WAP drop you off on a subnet, have the subnet do DNS lookups maybe off a device, or maybe you can hard code it somehow, that lands you on a reverse proxy that does your PAT and your NAT for you and drops you off in an external edge on the external side of the pool.
Yeah. I never thought about that. That's
okay, so, and now that's a meeting solution because since, when did the Link mobile client come out? So the 2013 mobile client published whenever it published. I don't think I've done a project since then that didn't have four or five or six major groups, marketing, sales, the VPs, the CXOs, all wanting with their iPad their mobile solution to work. And I've got an iPhone in my pocket. Does anybody not have a smartphone in this room? Everybody wants them things to work, and they want them to work when they walk in out of the parking lot. The only thing that I see on TMG that there was a solution for us on that is it was doing content inspection.
And web application firewall and GitHub service and all the other nice stuff about TMG that we don't
give. Preach it, brother. It makes the F word with the five after it that have that really, they've got a lot of solution sets that have come together. Sorry. But that's a potential answer for what you just brought up, because they do have a synergistic solution set that has all those elements into it. Yeah. There's more than one out there, but now we start talking a higher end device, and the higher end device goes cha-ching, cha-ching more often. I'm sorry?
It's a little bit expensive. We have a few of them.
Yeah, there's also, not that I would ever suggest that, I'm vendor agnostic in this room, but there's a vendor out there that's still pushing TMG appliances. And when I called them and said, are you still supporting this? They said, absolutely. No. They've got a license to put TMG on an appliance, and they're putting it out the door. Get with me afterwards, and we'll look it up real quick, and I'll show you. Anything else? Here's your security slide. Firewalls, reverse proxies, certificates. We'll get to that in just a second. And SBC for the voice. I like using a full SBC on a SIP trunk. If I'm going to be putting it in dial-in conferencing, I assume, perhaps incorrectly, that within about 6 months, they're going to want full enterprise voice for at least a subset of their users. And so why have them put in appliance A today only to change it down the road a little bit? So I try to have a little bit of consideration in the planning section for it. My experience tells me that if we take this action here, a little bit down the road, I'm going to have this other action that's going to take place, and let's not do it twice. That make sense? I mean, it's just something I've kind of developed over the years, is that I hate doing things twice when I can do it once today and not take the action later on. Certificates, Link uses public certs on the outside facing components across the board. If you want to get really, really secure, you'll take your trusted root cert from the inside and send it to your business partners and ask them to put it on their edge server and give it to all their clients, and that's as secure as you can get, short of pulling the power out of it. I've done a couple of deployments that way. It's an admin nightmare, but it does work, and it does definitely constrain your traffic. Certificates from Entrust. Everybody knows that Entrust has an intermediate cert that sometimes doesn't work too hot. I walk around on my laptop, and I've got the Entrust stack, so if I run into that, I can just publish it out. Reverse proxy, I think we've already kind of beat that a little bit to death. The reverse proxy's purpose in life, for Link at least, is to provide the content redirection so I can get by with one address instead of two, depending on how many edges I'm going to have, how many sites I'm going to have. And it's also giving me a port address translation off of 443 onto a 4443. Past that, there is content inspection that the firewalls typically provide. I don't know about the DDoS stuff too much, because I can't really speak to that level of network attacks. I'm sure there's a script kiddie out there that knows how to get around anything I put in place. So I try to get to that 99% bracket without spending the last $1 million to get to that last percentage point. I figure that's the best I can do. Yes?
Is UAG fully supported for publishing the Link 2013 reverse proxy content?
That's a great question. fully supported, meaning every modality?
Well, is mobile supported, but is it specifically supported in this?
Mobility support is not there.
Yeah, okay.
At least it wasn't the last time I checked. So I never even talk UAG to customers anymore. And I probably should. But it didn't do what I needed to do, so we had to have another solution for it.
Okay.
It's an unfortunate answer right up with the TMG.
Thanks.
Sorry. Firewalls. Let's go back over firewalls. You're probably hearing firewalls and networks out of me a lot, and here's why. I've done, 50, 60 link deployments over the last 3 years. Starting off with Link 20 betas on the 2010 side, working my way all the way through all the various versions. In 100% of those deployments, it's been firewalls and networks that have been our problem. Anybody network engineer in here that does that for a living, that does nothing with networks, so I can talk bad about you? They all swear there's not a problem. And so you start proving it to them, and all of a sudden, oh yeah. So if you get nothing else out of me over the next couple of minutes, remember this. If you're having trouble and it works internally, your edge and your reverse proxy and all the rest of that, those problems are more than likely firewalls or networks. If one of the two, if it works internally and you can go to your front end, for instance, and go telnet FQDN at the edge pool, port 5061, and it works, and you can get 3478, and you can get the 15,000 for the centralized log and that kind of thing. If that's working, but it doesn't work to the outside world, I'd be looking at firewalls and networks. It'd be the first place I would be looking.
Yeah, I got an issue where Link O works in the U.S., doesn't work in the EMEA.
Where's the ingress point?
In the U.S.
So they're coming all the way across?
Yeah, but it just doesn't go back. But I can actually see the connections hitting the firewall in all of the remote sites where we test it.
Can you see them? Can you see it leaving your site also?
I see it leaving our site, and I see it hit on the other side. I can't say for certain that I see the return path. Usually, if it gets there, it's stable, so it should be able to get back.
You'd think, huh?
Well, that was what I was looking at on the weekend. That's what I'm saying.
I got a project in San Diego that we're kind of in the last very, we're going to close it in about 2 weeks after they get, after they say, okay, we got all the problems worked out. And one of the problems we had was that their firewall guy had opened it, an ASA, mind you, had opened it up, 5061. I could see him. He couldn't see me. He opened up 5061 inbound but not outbound. On an ASA, that's hard to do, because ASA, if you open it up inbound, it's usually reciprocal.
Yeah, that's me. We have ASAs as well.
Well.
Here's the thing, the link lines work fine. It's just link mobile.
If you take a look at your static inside-outside inside pair, where you start taking the authorization for the NAT, and then compare that to the ACL inside, if you have some sort of DMZ prescribed,
right.
Compare those two, and you might find a little bit of a mismatch, maybe. I've just now exhausted all my ASA knowledge. Okay, where do we start with Edge? You always start, if you're going to be deploying this thing and you're going to, and think about the planning of it, always start with a single Edge. Don't try to go, hey, we're going to do three of these things. Start with one. Get one figured out in your head. Once you figure out one, you can add a second one. My experience is that every time I start talking about more than one, people start glossing over. Okay, and we don't want that. So figure out one edge, figure out one set of edge services, get that working, and then add a second one. The problem, of course, is that we want to add a second one, so you need to plan it ahead of time so that when the changes need to take place, you've already figured the changes out. It's just a matter of implementing them, and then you're proving the concept as you step through each stage. A single edge with a single reverse proxy, that's two servers. Provided, of course, we're not using a device for reverse proxy. When you add additional edges, there's my statement about looping back through all the planning. You'll see it here in a bit. There is a methodology of letting the same SIP traffic, so all of our SIP coming in on 5061 and 443, to land on two active edges at the same time. and then let the media flows happen as they will. Again, we'll flip back onto another slide and say, how big is that WAN link between site A and site B? They had a DS3, so they were not worried about their SIP traffic going back and forth. It was just literally a drop in the bucket to them. But on the other one I'm going to show you, there's one site in Germany and one site in South Africa. Anybody ever dealt with South Africa WANs?
Yeah.
Like, oh my goodness. Can we please get into the 20th century? It's like they got two guys with a soup can and a piece of string running down there.
India's not that bad. Indonesia is worse.
South Africa was like, it's painful. All right, second site edge. Here we've now added to our basic, what we were running before, we've now added a second site. And we've added a second edge to it. So what's the implications here? Well, we added two more firewalls. We added two more subnets. In the world of HA and DR, we now have the ability to come up live on this second edge as a full service in case the first one goes down. So what plans would you have to make? What DNS changes might you have to make? What admin changes might you have to process out and get documented for training purposes to put into place to allow that change to happen? How much of this could be handled by a GeoDNS? How much might be handled by a GTM, let's say like an F5 or something where they can just move things over for you? And how much might need to be done? Do you have a question? Okay. How much might need to be done manually? And this is outside of the Link 2013 DR resiliency plan, where if you do a pool failover, you got to take some manual actions kind of thing. This is edge stuff, world stuff, DNS coming in. How many people have their TTL cranked way down? Like to 5. Yeah, 300 is max TTL if I can get away with it. Because I don't want to tell anybody to reboot or log off and log back in, wait 5 minutes. I want it to be happening constantly. And yeah, we generate a little bit of DNS traffic, but the end result is if something bad happens and I need them to change over, they change over almost immediately on their own. I talked about static routes. If this guy comes up live, all the static routes for this side need to be crossed over server to server. So if I had static routes put into this edge to get to this site or sites multiple plural, this edge server is going to need them as well, because if you ever want to come up on this one live for everything, it needs to be able to come in. How many people know how to change their federated route and their next hop routes in Topology Builder off the top of their head? If your edge goes down, you need to come up on that second edge. There are certain actions that you're going to have to take to make sure that your federation routes and your next hop routes are correct. There's a PowerShell command for the one, and it's Topology Builder for the other. I swear that's right, and I'm probably wrong.
Why isn't that one sitting dormant, though? Why not just load balance the two edge servers?
Well, I'm going to stipulate that you're correct.
Okay.
For this drawing here, I wasn't trying to illustrate that, but these could easily be full pools, at which point I've just doubled up all my HLBs, all my DNSLBs, all my IP requirements.
All your namespace.
Yeah, exactly.
Is that separate entries for
Yes and no.
Without,
without something, correct, which is why I have that scenario in the planning considerations, because we would want to think about that before we started pushing buttons to deploy, before we started working our way through what's it going to take for a change order in a larger organization. Just the change order alone, the paperwork for it could be considerable.
Because you can't tell those users that are over on that pool to use those different URLs, right?
It depends on how you want to put it together. Again, another planning consideration. What I'm going to be demonstrating here in a minute is this right here in two different ways, one of them in Frankfurt and one of them in South Africa, how we did that one. But I also have another example of what this right here was a DS3. And so other than the second edge pool having separate WC and AV DNS names for this pool to have media flow, everything ran back and forth all together. And in fact, we built the certs so either one can handle both loads. So in case they pulled one of them off, both of them would handle everything. That's sort of what you were looking for?
Kind of. You have users in each of these pools, right?
Yes, active. Talking about the simple URLs? It's going to, yeah, it's going to, the AV will be different because it's a different pool.
Yeah.
And the WC will be different because it's a different pool.
And you can set that in their profile?
You don't set it in their profile. They get in-band provisioning of it because of their pool membership.
Okay.
And that's what, by the way, it's a really good observation you make. On the planning side, you've got the one piece, the client consideration. And on the server side, you got the server consideration piece. How do I get in and out? What's my construction look like? On the client side, it's pretty easy. If I put them in a different pool, they sign off, sign back in, they get inbound provision for the other pool. And so if they then make a meeting change or make a new meeting, their meeting invite goes out with the new URL. For our South Africa project, we put different simple URLs in per site also. That's exactly what we did. Yes. Again, think about all this stuff before you start, or you'll be in there changing certs.
So if you had federated partners that were in South Africa that had better bandwidth into that edge, you could tell them to use that edge as their federation.
Yeah, and would we have done it differently in the end? Maybe, but we would have needed better bandwidth. All right, boy, I'm almost out of time here. Some real world stuff. This is New York and New Jersey, two complete sites, DS3 in between them. We ran SIP, WC, and AV on all edges, two pools. And here's your answer. SIP to both of them at the same time, active, and they just let the SIP setup traffic run across the DS3 because they didn't care about the size. People in New York handed out an invite for New York for their pool. People in New Jersey handed out URLs for their pool. It's not a documented recommended solution, but if you talk to your TAM, they can probably get you documentation for it. And here's what the mess looks like with numbers and server names. That's one site of the two. So for you, you might potentially have 20 or 30 of these. The bad part is that I can't show you the WAN link here. If you go to a different project where I had a very similar layout, this could be the determining factor of I'm only going to have one pool that's going to handle the entire West Coast because I have good bandwidth. Or I might need to put one in San Jose and one here and one up in Portland and maybe one in Las Vegas because I've got groups of users that I want to keep their message, their conferencing traffic to a manageable size because I know we're going to have a lot of meetings there. Barbelling has been asked for I don't know how many years. Hasn't showed up yet. They keep saying they're working on it. Here's the other one that I was talking about. ZA is over on this side, Frankfurt's on that side, and you'll notice that I got to use TMGs for this one, which was very nice. The SIP single domain, which you're not supposed to see there because I should have scrubbed it, they do so much business that they stood up a whole other pool for them just for those people, and because they know the WAN link was bad, they know they had traffic problems, they know they had bandwidth considerations that they had to consider. They had to do this. They didn't want to. This is what was forced on them by their physical network. That's another look at what they laid out to. I included this just so you can see all the moving parts to a certain degree. Link is, to my mind, very, very simple. Just this 5,000 moving parts. And if we change one, we could easily change the relationship somewhere else. If we change the WAS VIP, we have a cascade of changes that go all the way out to our external DNS that we have to consider. You can't just change one thing over here and go, oh, that's all I got to change. You got to consider the entire client path all the way out to the world and back in. I see a question you want to ask. No? Okay. That's the second site. All right, takeaways. And I've been preaching it now for an hour and 15 minutes. Plan, 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 plan. I don't have all the answers to give. There's not a stock set of answers to give you. I can't give you, you know, step 1 through 26. This just isn't going to happen. Okay, do we have about a minute? Well, it can't take that long to come up, can it? This is the FQDN and DNS IP chart for that other site that I showed where I had the DS3 in between them. And when we got done with the planning and design consideration sessions, we ran down this list, and it runs ...111 lines down the page. And this isn't a big organization. They just put a full pool in place with a full double edge, and they have another pool in another office. So it's got three SQLs. This one's got three SQLs. There's three edge pool. You know, there's all these servers and components. Pardon me. And this is the level of the planning that I think is required before we start pushing buttons on building servers. And I've been involved in a lot of projects where they didn't do this, and we're back in there later doing this chart for them so we can figure out what the heck is going wrong. Why aren't we getting traffic from spot A to spot B? I promise you a DNS look. It's only same project. It's only 88 lines long. This is the DNS records needed, internal and external, to support that organization. And it boggles my mind that when people don't do this. DNS external is a little bit shorter list, but the same idea holds. It goes down the page, and we figured it out before we started. The advantage here is that if you figure it out before you start, when you're putting it into place, if something's not working the way you expect it to, you start right back here and take a look at what I've done, what I needed to do, what my desired outcome was. You need to be able to plan out your expected reaction. Pardon me. Your expected outcomes of your test scenarios, and you can't plan that unless you know what you start from, which is my approach. And the last one's the fun one. This is an eye chart of the certs required. I always like to look at that in that view. This right here lists each cert for each server in the pool and in the edge. And yeah, it's an eye chart, and I'm willing to share it if you want to see it. But this thing, I lay this out per server, per role, per internal, per external. And if you think about it, by doing this, it allows you to realize that, hey, I can use that same cert over here on the reverse proxies because it lists all the same names. You might double up a couple of them, but that's fine. Especially on the externals where you're buying them from somebody else, you don't want to be talking to VeriSign would be the one to really
mention. Other than the edge, why not just use wildcard, which is what we've started doing?
You can. For reverse proxy, and a wildcard works. To answer the question, be better. On the, are you talking about on the front ends for the web services? You can use them there too.
Actually, for all of the
services. Well, it's not supported for one.
Yeah. Okay.
That's the biggest answer right there.
But you can't use them on the inside, though, right?
I know it's not on the edge.
The edge needs to have, if you want to use an edge with a wildcard, you have to have SIP domain.com, and the next entry can be a wildcard. That's the supported solution. The biggest reason not to do one on the inside edges, or on the inside of your FQDM for your pool members, is that the link phone editions don't like it.
Pardon?
Link phone editions do not like wildcards.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so we don't use those.
Yeah. On internal certs, I'm going to generate them things anyway. Click, 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 click. If I need 30 of them, I'm going to get 30 of them. It's the outside part that I'm worried about for cost and planning consideration.
So what we found is that the link client on Macs do not like internally issued domain certificates.
So there's two ways around that one. You can
export.
There's an extension that you can do to AD that allows Macs to join the domain, at which point they get shoved to the cert. Like any other radio member, AD member, that works pretty well.